Hello and welcome to another edition of the C-Squared Podcast. It's your host, Curtis, with my co-host, Aaliyah. And we are here once again with Mr. Jordan Blum, who is an author. He is a freelance writer. He does a lot of writing for a lot of different places, actually. He writes for Loudwire. He writes for Metal Injection and like prog, classic rock. I'm going to forget like a ton of different things. So I'm just going to name those ones and say thank you, Jordan, for braving us and coming on the podcast.
Oh, thanks for having me back. It was a pleasure last time. I'm sure it will be this time as well.
It's going to be amazing is what it is.
Very optimistic. We appreciate
high benchmarks it.
We've got high benchmark is what we got over here. Aaliyah, do you want to start the procedures, the interrogation?
Sure. Well, Jordan, for those who aren't aware, could you give us a brief background of who you are and what you do in the realms of metal beyond what Curtis said?
Sure, yeah. So Jordan Blum, I've been writing about music professionally, I would say, for about 15 years. I like all sorts of music, but I do specialize in progressive rock and metal, not even just rock and metal, but progressive and art rock and symphonic and that stuff. These days I'm mostly at Loudwire and Metal Injection. I'm an editor at Pop Matters, do some stuff for What Culture too. So just try to kind of put my name in as many places as I can and hopefully, you know, do a good job at it.
What's your favorite type of piece to write?
It's probably the most difficult, but the most rewarding is like the anniversary piece. Because I love doing these lists, you know, it's so much fun, but they're not super challenging, whereas writing like an anniversary piece for an album, or I've been doing a lot of movies for Consequence lately of like 25th, 30th anniversaries of movies. And those require a lot more research, a lot more annotation and combining sources and thoughts and kind of coming up with my own argument and really fleshing it out. So I think ultimately those are the most difficult to do, but once I'm done and I sit back and I see it on the website, it's definitely the one that gives me the most pride.
So just to clarify on something, just one thing that popped in my head last time we talked about, maybe I asked this and I totally forgot. Basically, you get paid for your hobby, right? Mm-hmm. Basically, you're getting paid for a hobby that you do. So like you're going to be watching movies anyways, and you're going to be listening to music anyways.
Yeah, that's true.
So there's a point to this though. So how often do you get to pick the movies, for example, that you write about versus it being assigned?
I would say like 90% of the time. Like every so often somebody, you know, might email me and say, this is coming up, would you want to write about it? It's never like an obligation. It's just always that I usually take it because I like chance to write about it. I like the chance to kind of get my name in the place again. But usually what I do is, especially for the anniversaries, is like the around like the 10th to the 15th of every month, I'll kind of go on Wikipedia and see what album anniversaries are coming up, what movie anniversaries. I'll cross check that with other sources to make sure that I'm right about it. Because I do that for Pop Matters anyway, because I have to get us all the writers a list of things for them to write about every month for that. So then I'll just say, all right, of all the ones I came up with, which ones do I think I know the most about or have the most passion for? Which one do I think will appeal most to publications and appeal most to readers? Because as you do this more, you realize that a big part of it is what can we get clicks for and what kind of will get us the attention. Yeah. Whether or not this is worth the attention and worth writing about, and maybe it's a great movie that deserves attention, but it's kind of a niche thing. So I kind of say, all right, here's the ones that I think are worth writing about that you would want me to write about. And of those, what appeals to you? And then usually they'll say, all right, of these three, send us like a more in-depth pitch. So that'll take me, it could take me an hour for one album or one movie pitch to really make sure I'm nailing what I want to say about it.
Yeah.
But it's always something that I want to write about.
So what would be an example of like a movie that you wanted to write about, but just couldn't get the clicks as far as you were concerned?
It's a good question. Even just for this month, like I really wanted to, I don't know what the exact reason was, but I really wanted to write about the Grindhouse, the 15th anniversary of Grindhouse, and kind of go into a whole bunch about that and how it was made and the retro aspect of it and how it kind of led to a lot of I think, similar movies. They kind of spearheaded that strange, like, modernization of, like, trauma movies for movies like Fried Berry or Psycho Gourmand or any of those kinds of movies. But I didn't get approved for it. So it's kind of like I wanted to write about it. I didn't get to, but that's okay.
What did you have to write about instead, out of curiosity?
So I'm actually writing about Hot Fuzz, which I have to start next week. Oh. So that was one out of three. Like, I pitched those two. I pitched Raising Arizona. And it has to do with budgeting, too. So I know that for that one, they said, all right, for right now, we could definitely green light this one. And then who knows for later in the month what you might get. So, for example, like last month, I wrote about, I'm trying to remember what it was. Was it Lost Highway? Might have been Lost Highway. And then she came back and said, all right, we have a bit more money and time. How about The Godfather? So I got two for last month.
Nice.
So it depends on a lot of different factors.
Fair enough. Aaliyah, I'll let you continue with the regular questions if you want, since I'm going way off.
Sure. Yours. Well, this is kind of relevant because I guess, what would you say to bands who complain about the fact that, Metal Injection's always posting about Corey Taylor or whatever? Like, obviously there's a reason behind all of that. Can you, what would you say to people who complain about that? Or maybe don't even understand?
Do you mean like bands or readers?
Yeah, like bands.
I would say it's kind of an unnecessary obligation. Part of it is that it's like anything else. Like, on one side, you always want to promote the bands that deserve it the most, you know, as a writer, as a magazine, as an editor, whatever it is. If you could do it all just for the art of it, you would want to write about the most deserving ones. But the other side of it is, especially, and I don't know much about like the business side of any of these sites because I'm just a writer, but to get the advertising, to get the funding, to get the clicks, I'm sure there's a certain level of, you know, getting the popular topics going. So I think it's just an unnecessary kind of part of the system is, you know, the stuff that will get the most attention is prioritized. But I certainly do all I can to highlight bands and artists that deserve it.
Yeah. Do you have any idea on the metrics on those? Because you mentioned, like, how many clicks does a article need to get like a approval?
I don't really know.
I'm sure it's a ton. I don't know, but.
Yeah, I don't look at that side of it. I've gotten some feedback on some stuff I've done just out of the blue of like, hey, you know, this was really popular. Just so you know, this is how many clicks it got. This is how many page views it got. But, mm-hmm. You know, that's just kind of like them letting me know that something I did, I guess, worked.
Okay. Luckily, so what was an example of something like that? Like, maybe you don't have to tell us what the article was, but what were the metrics on it that you got?
I was told that something I did at Loudwire was the most popular of the month. I think it got over 5 million, which to me was like, oh, okay.
Nice.
And my response to all of it, because I'm sure it wasn't all positive support. It was probably, what about this? What about that? But my response to all of it, and this is what I tell other writers, authors, or whatever, I say, three some awards, thanks for reading. Like, whether they loved what you did, hated what you did, want to complain about it, thanks for reading.
Yeah.
Do you know what it comes down to? Do you know what the 5 million views article was by chance?
I don't remember off the top of my head.
Okay.
It might have been one of the big four. I did two. I did the big four of like metal.
Okay.
Or other kinds of metal. And I did the big four of rock and emo. I think it was one of those.
I could see why that would get 5 million hits, okay?
Oh, sure, because people will be like, no, you forgot this band. This band should be in this genre. I remember reading that article and thinking some of those things.
Yeah, I mean, everybody does. You're not going to please everyone all the time. And what's just fascinating to me, and I mention this on every like kind of interview I ever do, is why like the average fan, the average person gets so involved in it. Like, and it's interesting because I do this for somewhat of a living, even though I teach mostly. But like, if somebody wants to badmouth the Beatles, if somebody wants to say that like Donnie Darko is an awful movie, I don't care. Like, I don't understand why people. I'm fascinated by it. I think it plays into like parasocial relationships, but I'm fascinated by how people get into what a publication says about their favorite artists. Like, you don't know the artist. Why are you fighting for them? You don't know them.
Yeah.
I just find it fascinating.
It's definitely fascinating.
So, actually, Aaliyah, go ahead. I think I was about to cut you off.
No, you can go ahead.
Okay, so let's talk about this for a second here. Let's dive deep into the psychology of the fan mindset. Well, we're probably not going to be able to do that, but you know what I mean. So why do you think that is, that people do that?
I mean, it's always been the idea that you get your identity from the things you like. It's the same reason why, like, when you're showing somebody a YouTube video that you really like, you're watching their reaction and you want to see if they like it. Because if they don't laugh as much as you did, you think they don't like you. Like, it shouldn't be that deep, but I think it is for all of us. It's just how we see ourselves. We judge ourselves by how others see us and all. So I think it's that idea of, like, if you don't say this is the best Alice in Chains song, you know, you're calling into question my judgment and my view and my worldview. And it's like, it's just music. It's just a movie. It's not that serious.
But it seems like to me, and maybe I'm mistaken in this, that it seems like there's certain genres that seem to have more of that than others. Oh, yeah. Like prog, for example, I'm just using that, right? A lot about prog seems to have a lot of like rabid
people
in it. And same with like symphonic, which I know Aaliyah's into. But why do you think it is that some genres, like those two, for example, would be so insane about that? Well, not insane, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, that's a good question. I think it's because I can really mostly speak for the prog side of it, but I think it's that prog has always been it's been popular at certain points with like Emerson, Lake and Palmer in the early 70s, but it's always been such a like club, like a niche kind of like insider under the radar thing.
Mm-hmm.
I think in particular, like if you're a prog rock fan and you find other prog rock or prog metal fans, you feel like you're in this tight-knit community, and it's a great thing, and it's like, it's special. It's like, this is ours. The mainstream won't accept it, you know, except for what just happened with Dream Theater and the Grammys. Like, prog music usually doesn't get the attention it deserves, and I agree with that. So I think it's very much like, this is ours. Stay out of it. How dare you insult it? You know, what else do we have to maybe cling to except for this?
Yeah, I can understand that. Aaliyah, did you want to add or say anything more to Jordan about that before I do a follow-up?
I think that's pretty, you know, accurate across, like, to symphonic metal as well, it applies. I want somebody, I know this is never going to happen, but I was like, oh man, it would be really cool to do like a big five personality type survey of everybody who's into different genres of metal and see if there's like a trend or some kind of statistical correlation between personality types and music genre preference. But I mean, I don't think that nobody can make money from that. So
probably not. But there have, I mean, like we did something about like, you know, was it 10 Signs You're a Tool Fan? I think I did. And I did, but like other people have done other ones and they're all like tongue in cheek, but there certainly are like specific attributes to certain fans.
Yeah, for sure.
You did 10 Signs You're a Tool Fan? That just sounds like the most hilarious thing ever.
Yeah, it was like, you like mystical stuff. You're into like, you know, you love when songs go beyond 10 minutes and albums go into 79 minutes. It was all like a joke. And I love Tool. I love Tool.
I like
Death Row Tull fans, there certainly are certain like attributes.
Yeah, no, I can see that. Just out of curiosity, what's your take on the Dream Theater Grammy when I saw Metal Sucks were not pleased by it? I don't know if you saw that article, but
I didn't see it.
Chris was mad.
I'm trying to remember who else was nominated.
I have it here. It was Deftones, Gojira, Mastodon, and Rob Zombie were the other nominees.
The only one of those albums that I really got into was the Mastodon, and I would put the Mastodon over it. I mean, like, I've always been kind of like, I wrote a book on Dream Theater. I'm still kind of like critical of them, that I thought this album, like the self-titled and like Distance Over Time before it, were very by the numbers. Like, it was Dream Theater being Dream Theater. They were grandfathered into it, which is why like one of the albums on the list that we were just talking about, the 25, is The Astonishing, because The Astonishing is so polarizing. And I agree with a lot of it. Like, I don't love that album, but it's different. At least they tried something different. And that's what I always want out of bands, is like, do something different. Stop repeating yourself.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah, I think the Mastodon one would have been the only one I would have picked too. The Gojira one, I'm like.
But I mean, like, I see it almost as like a legacy thing, because, you know, they Dream Theater have been around as Majesty for almost 40 years now.
Yeah, so it's been a long,
like a legacy, like lifetime achievement. So good for them. And if it brings more attention to like Prague in general, you know, that's great.
And they're one of the bands with the rabid fans. Rabid.
Oh, yeah. I knew a few of them. Some people who, you know, Mike Portnoy left Dream Theater. Dream Theater died in September 2010. It's like, shut up.
I know. It's insane. It's totally insane.
Especially with Mike Portnoy. That's the thing. Like, Mike Portnoy moved on from me. I've spoken to him about it. He is done. So why are these people holding like candles for this when he's like, they've reconciled? Let it go.
Well, I'm kind of getting out of that whole thing. This is my own personal opinion, and I'm not big into Dream Theater, so crucify me on this, because you probably know a lot more about Dream Theater than I do. But I think it's kind of boils down to the thing, like you said, with the identity, having it held in the identity, because he was part of all those albums and stuff like that. That's
I mean, again, like some of the people that I knew, especially one person in particular, I won't mention. Like he was Dream Theater. That was his identity. That's all they ever talked about. That was his life. And when you get when you become that fanatical about like anything, and to me it borders on cultism, and it's like,
yeah,
the same way we see like religion and politics. Like, you can like what you like, but don't live for this stuff, because they certainly aren't living for you. So, you know, keep it all in a logical level.
Fair. Jordan just brought up religion and politics, Aaliyah. I can't believe it. Someone brought up religion and politics on this podcast without even being prompted.
Never.
That's hilarious. Aaliyah, get us back on track. So we're going to go into controversial.
Where to go from here? It's such an interesting topic, but I guess
negative.
You mentioned that. What's that?
So I always feel like I get very like negative and rant about bad stuff, as if I don't love what I do for a living. I very much do.
But that's kind of your job. That's kind of your job, though, is to rant.
Yeah.
Well, like to call it as I see it, because I know so many people who do what I do. I've spoken to them. They will kiss a lot of butt. They won't dare like say what they're thinking. They won't dare ask an interview question that maybe the person like isn't safe. Whereas I'll be like, look, I want to know the answer to this. With all due respect, I want to ask a question that isn't like a softball. And that's what you got to do as a writer.
When it comes to asking unpopular, non-softball questions, do you have like a way that you couch them or ask them to make people not immediately reject you?
I think like the key to that, and it should go without saying, but it doesn't, you know, you find that it doesn't, is you want to prove to the person you're interviewing that you actually are a fan of theirs, like you know their work. Because so many times, I've had like a lot of people tell me that they're like, they can tell that I'm asking questions as somebody who knows their work, because otherwise you run into like a Larry King situation, not to speak ill of the dead, but of like, you're on my show, but I clearly don't know anything about you. So I think, especially with a few examples like I can think of, it's like, I'm clearly a fan of yours. That's why I care so much. That's why I want to know and kind of ask you these deep things, because I have been following you. I do know your work. So I think that's important to keep them, you know, to keep the person feeling like they're welcomed in that sense, that they are talking to somebody who is a fan, and that's why they're, you know, daring to ask this question, I guess.
So, Aaliyah, am I allowed? Okay, just make sure. Let's talk about interviews for a brief second here. I'm just trying to recollect what we talked about last time, and I'm hoping I'm not retreading any familiar ground here. And if I am, I apologize to listeners who are listening here. What's the Jordan Blum 101 on how to get a good interview done?
Try to look at all facets of what they're promoting. And definitely, like, I mean, the best thing I think like a promoter could do or publicist is kind of give like talking points. That's always helpful. But
you like, because I've heard people say they don't. So, but anyways, I cut you off. Go ahead.
No, I mean, because especially if there's like certain angles, because you always want to like have a different angle to it, because there's certain things that like everybody's asking the same questions, and to a certain extent you need to. It's like, yeah, you know, again, going back to the clicks, like there are certain questions you're going to get asked. And, you know, even being on the other side of that, promoting these books, there's certain questions I've been asked in every interview, but that's fine. I'm, you know, I'm happy to talk about it. So I would say have a good balance of that, but also have a good balance of like your own unique questions that other people won't be able to find elsewhere, that the interviewee, you know, they may perk up because you're like, oh, nobody's asked me that. I didn't think anybody would want to kind of go into that territory, especially when you bring in other weird interests. Like you start talking about like pop culture, you start talking about teaching, yep, and you realize like they open up more because they feel like their guard's down because they're not like representing the label as much. They're like, oh, you're just talking to me as if I'm another person. This is a change of pace for me.
Yep.
I think that's really the key to it.
So let me ask you this then, Jordan. So like we're helping you a little bit with the campaign for your book.
Yeah, which is so awesome.
But so here's the question I have. So has being the interviewee, do you think that's kind of made you kind of think more about how to ask interview questions, or does it really not affect you with your writing, if that makes sense?
I think it has, because again, I've realized the necessity of asking certain questions.
Yeah.
And the, how that will come up. Like, and it's, I always try to think of like a different way to put it, but it's always basically kind of the same answers.
Of course.
So I think that's made me appreciate what it can be like to be on the kind of promotion trail and being asked the same questions. And again, as much as you appreciate any of the attention, anybody cares.
Yeah.
I do realize like, you know, I'm probably not the 10th person to ask you this, and I probably won't be the last one by a mile.
Yeah.
So it definitely helps me kind of feel like I should mix and match a bit more than maybe I used to.
Fair. I got one more before I shoot it back over to Aaliyah here, but so you had mentioned going into like personal things, like for example with your teaching and stuff. Do you think like let's say, so like with you promoting your book, how personal should the interviewer get with you then if you're promoting your book, do you think? Or like if you're talking to a musician, for example, how personal, like how much interest do you think the journalist should take with the interviewee personally versus artistically, if that makes sense?
Yeah, it does. I think as personal as you can get while being respectful and relevant. Like, okay, dig deeper again, especially if you have that personal connection, if you judge the vibe too, like read the room. Makes me think of, I don't know why, it makes me think of that interview Robert Downey Jr. did where the guy was asking about his drug addiction and he's like, I'm here to promote a movie, and it's like, you don't need that far with it. But certainly if it's relevant and if you feel like the person's comfortable enough being asked, dig deeper, bring up things that maybe they don't expect, that you didn't even expect to ask, that your reader or your listener didn't expect, to keep it unique and interesting. As long as it's all kind of on point, as long as it's never clearly turning into like a negative vibe or what would they call it, like a smear piece or something.
Yeah.
But other than that, get personal.
Yeah, no, I understand. I'm just trying to think of some examples for it, but I'll let Aaliyah do the next question because I've been talking for the last 5 minutes.
Oh, good. It's all good and all great information. I mean, I know we have a lot of people of different disciplines listening to our podcast, so hopefully this will help them write better interviews. And while we're... let's just move on to talking about writing, because that is what you do. You mentioned before that your degree was in creative writing and poetry.
MFA, a master's in fine art. So I'm a master, I guess, whatever that
means. You're a professor?
Yeah.
What, do you teach the same thing, creative writing?
I try to work that in there. I'm an adjunct, so I usually just take like the entry level foundational 101, 102 classes, which I love doing. And at a few schools, a few classes, I am able to bring in more of the creative writing. So for example, like one of the schools in particular, I always start the semester the first month. We talk about music, but we also talk about fiction and poetry and kind of the idea that beneath the surface, there's always an argument being made. So like, whether it's entertaining, whether it's like horrifying, funny, whatever it is, what is the author trying to say beneath the surface? That's an argument, just to kind of show students how everything and anything in life is an argument. We try to incorporate it.
That's interesting. So how do you feel like, do you feel like there are things you've experienced in your working life as a writer that you weren't taught about when you were in college?
Yeah, I think the how much you maybe have to like work to get your name out there, and that you won't always like get paid at first, and it could be a struggle, and the persevere. I mean, they always tell you to be persistent, but I don't recall really getting a life lesson in that so much. I just remember a lot. It's like a lot of theory and not as much practice, I guess, at least from my experience. And also just the idea that like, there are certain things you have to do as a writer that like are the rules, but everyone has to have their own voice at some point. And what works for one place, you know, may not work at another place. And
sure.
It's kind of the flexibility of it, and realizing that just because like somebody doesn't go for it, it's not a reflection on you necessarily. It could be what the specific thing you're pitching to them may not be it, but that doesn't mean they don't want you.
So, yeah, and I think in creative disciplines, a lot of people encounter this push and pull of when do you demand that you get paid and when do you do stuff for free? And people have to find that balance on their own. But do you have any advice for people struggling with that?
I mean, it's the kind of like cliched phrase of know your worth. So like know what you've accomplished and I guess how in demand you are and how much you've gotten better at what you do and how much more you've established yourself. But also, I mean, it's tricky because I know so many people who refuse to like write for free. They think if you ever write for free, you're being exploited.
Yeah.
And from my perspective, it depends on if you're doing it for the love of it or not. Like if you're being honest about it, you're agreeing to do it. Like Pop Matters is always open that they don't pay. And, you know, I wish they did, they wish they could, but I understand why they don't. So whenever I've like said, hey, we're looking for writers, you know, that's one of the first questions. And I'm like, yeah, they don't pay, it's volunteer. And they'll say, oh, you're trying to like rip people off. And it's like, it's not me, it's them. But it's like, no, there's plenty of other benefits. You get published in a high caliber magazine, you get access to free, you know, music and you get to talk to people. There's many reasons to do it for free. But the other side of that is if you are trying to make a living out of it, at it, don't sell yourself short. Like understand what you're worth and what the going like average rate is for an album review or like a long form essay. And don't be afraid to ask for it. Don't be afraid to ask for, I don't know what the technical term would be, but like if there's a quick deadline, you may be able to get like a slight bonus for a quick turnaround. What they call like a kill fee. If something gets like cut, they'll give you a certain percentage of the rate because they can't do it. So kind of like know your rights, but also don't feel bad if you are doing it just because you love doing it. Like just because you don't get paid for it doesn't mean you're not a real writer or that you're less than. It's all about, you know, your craftsmanship.
Yeah, it's about, you know, judgment at times too, right? Because like you said, like for example, someone was writing for Pop Matters for free. They could use that as a resume for a bigger or a paid site, rather, maybe not bigger, but
yeah.
So
I mean, Pop Matters essays are like anthologized in like academic textbooks. Like I found stuff. I teach something called Male Bashing on TV right now that was written for Pop Matters in 2003, long before I ever got there. And I found it in this anthology. And I said, oh, I really want to use this anyway, because I like talking about like sexism in the media and gender roles and all. And I happened to look at like the bibliography and the bio of the author. And I said, oh, this was originally published at Pop Matters. That's pretty cool. And awesome. So there's definitely a lot of benefits outside of the money, but you know, just know what you're looking for.
Exactly. So I had a kind of a follow-up question on the writing aspect of things. So you obviously went to school for writing and stuff like that. So how do you think you needed that in order to land all the gigs you currently have? Or do you think you could have taken like a shortcut, maybe bypass that? Like, what are your feelings on this? Because I've heard different things, like you need to do that. Some people say you do, some people you don't, but you've done it and you're also a pro, so.
I think definitely like for the teaching aspect, yeah, for sure. Like you need some kind of master's degree to teach college, if not a doctorate. But yeah, people often ask like, do you need an MFA to be a good fiction writer or poetry writer?
Yeah.
And Yes and no. Because I think, like, if you have the craft, you have it. And if you have the expression and the ability, you will hone that. That's almost like you're born with it to a certain degree, like any other talent. Like, you have it or you don't to a certain level.
Yeah.
But I think certainly, like, the processing aspect of it, the peer reviewing aspect, the connections, the networking definitely help when you go to grad school or just college in general. And then for me, like, my writing in particular, and I teach some of my music writing, because I think I write very academically anyway. Yeah. And I kind of show that to my students. Like, even if it's a music review, I have a very set, like, template. If you look at my music reviews, not that anybody should necessarily, but if you look at my style, I have a very clear style. Like, intro paragraph, set up the context, thesis statement. Second paragraph is background information on the band and the album. And then, like, I write very much as I teach how to write an essay. So I think it's kind of been the perfect merger of me being able to do that. And I wouldn't have been able to find that, like, very specific balance had I not gone to school.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's kind of the same, like, with musicians who aren't necessarily trained. I mean, it works for some people that you don't have to be. For other people, it's like, would have been a necessity for them. So,
yeah. I mean, you look at, like, Zappa, who dropped out as soon as he got the music theory he needed. He's like, I don't need all of this. I know what I'm doing. I just need this one class to learn a little bit, and then I'm gone.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, yeah, I guess it is different for everybody. Lee, where are we going on this next? I could go off on different tangents.
Well, I wanted to. creative writing and poetry, I wanted to talk a little bit. Can you talk a little bit about how the disciplines of creative writing and poetry correlate to music journalism, and how they differ, or if there are any, like, maybe roadblocks if you take too much of a creative writing approach?
Yeah. I mean, I think creative writing, it's kind of in the name, like, there's more creativity to it. So there's more, like, freedom, especially with poetry, where, like, it can be so freeform. Like, there's so many forms of poetry. Like, you know, you have stanzas, you have iambic pentameter and sonnets and all, but more or less anything could be accepted as creative writing, as long as people like it. Whereas obviously, like, journalism, you have certain rules, you have to have certain, you know, like, you have to check off certain boxes with it. And I have, like, especially as an editor in Pop Matters, I've seen a lot of pieces that have a lot of great ideas and I really like them, but there's so much, like, creativity in the language and so much, like, personality, and so it's a uniquely written piece, but that kind of gets in the way of it flowing well and it making sense. So it's like, there's a lot of personality in what you're doing, but that's taking away from the readability of it. So you have to kind of get less creative with it and get more formal with it. And then certainly, like, I don't know if this is necessarily answering the question, I hope it is, but like, knowing the background of poetry and then reading lyrics, you start to see parallels. You start to see, like, I forget which I realized first, probably the music side of it. But then, like, growing up listening to, like, Genesis and Brian Wilson and the Beach Boys, and realizing that both of them quoted William Wordsworth in, like, A Child is Father of the Man and I Wandered Lonely as a Cloud from Lamb Lies Down. I was like, that's poetry? And of course, like, the name of my creative arts journal is The Bookends Review, which came from, like, Simon and Garfunkel. So it definitely helps seeing those parallels and realizing, especially with, like, progressive music, that so much of it is literary. Like, you have the concept album that is, like, you know, it's a novel in the musical form, sometimes literally. So it definitely helps to have both of those backgrounds and kind of, like, bits of knowledge to compare and contrast.
Yeah, I actually was just having this discussion with my father over the weekend about how people don't seem to care as much about lyrics anymore, and it's kind of sad. But I mean, it's definitely a byproduct of the, like, streaming culture and massive supply of music. People just don't sit on the same things for as long. But I think there are still people who care about lyrics. I mean, I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's inherent to, like, like, you like symphonic, I like prog. It's all overlapping, the artsy stuff, I guess.
Yeah.
But I mean, yeah, like, I mean, the best, like, Dream Theater lyrics, I think, are great. And the storytelling, I always think of, like, Symphony X's The Odyssey, which obviously is based on literature and that kind of thing. And to that point too, like one of my favorite things, I don't know about you, but like anything that goes along with this, I love conceptual continuity. I love when bands repeat lyrics throughout albums, or like, you know, the Deer Hunter, they begin and end like motifs from album to albums. A band like Riverside from Poland, they do that a lot. So whenever like I hear a lyric come back, or Cohen and Cambria is probably like the most famous example of a prog band doing that. So I lament that too. I wish people appreciated like the album as a sequence more, appreciated the storytelling, appreciated like how much thought goes into keeping the references and keeping this continuity between all this stuff. Or even just separately, like just analyzing how beautiful some of the lyricism can be. It's not just about like the music and the vocals.
Curtis, you have a follow-up to that?
I do and I don't. I was going to make a brief comment myself here. Do you really feel like, Jordan, though, that a lot of the times, like a lot of lyrics are even necessary? Because I mean, here's my problem. I have like I have a bit of a disagreement with you, Jim. I'm just going to say it. So I think lyrics, when done well, I agree with you guys. But I mean, there, a lot of times, like just horrible.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Maybe I'm mental and thinking this, but I just go like half the stuff I've listened to, it's been like the lyrics are just like an afterthought. Maybe that's the problem.
That's the problem.
I think it is. Yeah, I mean, I think it's like any creative writing. A lot of it's bad, but the good stuff is really good and it deserves more attention. But no, I'm right there with you. Like even again, like bringing up the Deer Hunter. Like I like the musical motifs. I love like a lot of the stuff, but if you ask me what is each song about, I can't tell you exactly song by song. And then you get some songs that have really terrible lyrics, but that's part of like the fun too.
Yeah.
So I agree. I mean, I don't think they're always necessary, but I think if there are good, they should get more appreciation than they do sometimes.
I agree. Like, I mean, like there's some band like Blue Oyster Cult were actually pretty good lyrically. I mean, didn't they have like a pro writer write for them, or am I thinking of someone else? Might have been Blue Oyster Cult. I can't remember, but
sure. I mean, you mentioned like we go back to like Brian Wilson and like Van Dyke Parks for Smile. Yeah. He was just the lyricist, and you know that got Mike Love really mad because you're singing about like all this abstract imagery and not girls and surfing and stuff. And
yeah,
I think in that case, it's like no, this is operating at a different level. And if you can't like keep up with it,
yeah. At the same time, though, I think there is also a place for the silly, simple lyrics too at the same time. So, I mean, it depends at the same time.
Yeah. I mean, like, Ali, I don't want to cut you off, but like my favorite example of all of this, and somebody I will always, and I'm not the only one, but like Devin Townsend, as I've said, anytime I can, is a genius. And he has some really, he's fascinating because he has such like philosophical, in-depth, spiritual, like mind-blowing stuff that like can reshape your opinion on life. Or you can sing about the goofiest, like, you know, going to hell to get a cheeseburger for deconstruction. But even his like goofiest stuff, there's like metaphysical stuff behind it. But sometimes you just want some really goofy shit to make you laugh, and that's fine.
Well, and that's kind of what I wanted to comment on. It's like even goofy stuff can be written well, and written poorly. Like I was just listening to a new song. I won't say what it is. But I was listening to a new band, new song, and I'm like, this is kind of annoying because it's just silly for the sake of being silly, and there's no artistry to the lyrics. I mean, it depends on the fan. There are plenty of people that go rabid over that stuff, but it's not clever in any way. It's just almost taking a bunch of memes, smashing them together, and here you go.
But that's sometimes not bad though. It depends on the context. Like
it depends on what you mean by bad. Oops. Sorry.
True.
Yeah.
To me, I just found it annoying and not lacking in craftsmanship, even though the music itself is really good.
But here's like a good example. Like you got someone like Jordan's probably gonna kill me for bringing these bands up, but I'm gonna do it anyways. Limp Bizkit and Bloodhound Gang. Fucking goofy as goofy. But I like to listen to them.
There's no such thing as like shame, like they call it like feeling shame for what you like. I mean,
but there's no artistry.
Sure all of us. Huh?
There's no artistry with either one of them. There's fucking none. You know, Foxtrot, Newborn, Charlie Kilo, like fuck.
Like, I find that, like, it's interesting because I've had so many people who think, for me, like, you write about Prague, you listen to Prague, that's all you must listen to, that's all you must be about. It's like, no, I'll always defend. I even wrote about, like, why Linkin Park's A Thousand Suns is incredible. I love No Doubt, Panic at the Disco, like Eminem. So it's not that it's like, that's the other thing. Like, there's a lot of snobbery in it because my music is more sophisticated technically. Yeah. If you don't listen to the same thing, you're not as evolved as me. But like, no, sometimes you don't need Yes to cover Simon and Garfunkel. You just need Simon and Garfunkel. You just need the Beatles doing what they did perfectly. And even to that extent, like, you know, to each their own.
Yeah, fair enough. Aaliyah, what are your thoughts on bands like Limp Bizkit and Bloodhound Gang type thing? I just want to hear, because I mean, like, you guys are both talking about artistry, and I'm like, I don't mind that sometimes.
No, I still feel like they have an amount of wit and like cleverness to what they do.
Fair.
And some stuff just doesn't have that.
I mean,
that's like, yeah, go ahead.
Go ahead, Jordan.
No, I was just gonna say, like, the only Bloodhound Gang song I remember is that "You and Me, Baby, Ain't Nothing But Mammals," whatever.
You're missing out, then. You need.
You need to go back.
Listen to the rest.
That's a good example. It's like, oh, it's clever. It's kind of funny. Yeah. It's like actual humor.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a big defender on the difference. Like, just because something is like profane or silly or goofy does not necessarily mean it's dumb. I'm a big defender. Like, South Park is brilliant sometimes. Even like, if either of you have watched Big Mouth, Big Mouth is like so incredibly profane and sexual. But beneath the surface, they're touching upon actual like puberty and adolescence. And like, there's deeper stuff beneath all of the like extremely profane stuff. So yeah, I'm a big supporter of, like, you know, what's going on beneath the surface, even if it's kind of goofy on, and even if it's just kind of dumb fun, like, you know, you don't always have to think all the time.
Sure. I think it's funny. We just got a Prague magazine writer to admit Bloodhound Gang has artistic merit to it. That's amazing to me.
I think most bands start with due to some degree.
Yeah. Aaliyah, where are we going with this for now? Because we're running out of time. It's already 7:48, I just realized.
I think we've talked about a lot of great stuff, and I think we should just wrap things up. And I actually have one more question, mm-hmm. because your new Opeth book is coming out very soon, mm-hmm. and you mentioned somewhere else that you were, when you pitched this publishing company or someone associated with it, that you were pitching writing some fiction or poetry. Is that still something that you want to do? Do you have any projects on the back burner that you're excited to get out there?
Yeah, I mean, I still, like, in the back of my mind, I still want to put that out. Because, yeah, like, it was initially an idea to put out a chapbook of, like, fiction or poetry or both, combining them. And people were telling me it's not marketable, you had to do one or the other, but yeah, it's like, here's what I have.
If you don't,
like,
listen it, to them. That sounds super interesting. Hybridize it.
Yeah. I called it, this is like a decade ago, I came up with the title of Mixed Signals, because it's like, you know, mixing genres, mixed signals, whatever. So I still have like a manuscript of that. What I think, I haven't looked at that in years, so I probably want to revise a lot of it. But yeah, I definitely want to someday kind of dig back into that. Because, you know, again, like, yeah, my degree is in fiction. I run this literary journal. So I almost feel like I'm like the face of this. I even tell my editors this, like, all of my editors are more accomplished with creative writing than I am in that sense. I feel like an imposter there. It's like, I took a detour over here to do music. So I do at some point want to come back and say, all right, now I'm going to really write more creative stuff, put this together, and have this side of my writing and I guess identity more like substantiated in an official like book. That's definitely something I want to do.
That sounds really cool. I mean, look at Shakespeare plays. The nobility spoke in poetry and the non-nobility spoke in not poetry. So why not make a book like that?
Yeah, I mean, that's what I'm always about, is just like, stop limiting yourself to like expectations necessarily. Like, and again, like, the most interesting stuff to me is the stuff that goes outside the box and like doesn't play by the rules. So even if there's no term for this, if it's never really been seen. If it's not marketable, as long as it's artistically fulfilling and it's interesting to some audience, it's worth doing.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Is that all you wanted to say, Jordan, or is there any final word before we wrap up?
No, that's just it. Thanks again for having me on. And yeah, the book, the OPETH book, On Track, comes out in, it's already in the UK, comes out in America on the 29th, I think. So right. Please pick it up, buy it for your friends, buy it in advance of like the holidays. Why not 8 months ahead of time? And by all means, let me know what you think of it. I'm happy to talk about what you think of it. If you disagree with me, it's all just a shared love of a band. So it's all in good fun.
All OPETH fans, attention. Where can they pick it up?
So the main place to get it is burningshed.com, which is like the official distributor for it. That's all, you know, and prog rock fans will know Burning Shed. Amazon, I know you can buy it online through Barnes & Noble. And I know at least in Philadelphia, it's been in a few, my other books have been in a few Barnes & Nobles, which is mind blowing to me. So you may be able to go in. And if you do find this book anywhere out in the wild, please take a picture of it and let me know. Even if you don't buy it, I just want to see if it's anywhere because that's amazing to me.
Cool.
Excellent. Should they tag you or hashtag something?
Yeah, tag me, send me a DM, whatever you need to do. I will never get sick of seeing this stuff and just kind of, you know, finding that it's finding its audience somewhere.
Excellent. Cool.
All right. Well, if that's all we have, Curtis?
That's it.
All right. Well, until next time, everyone, make like a bull and throw those horns up.